Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. This is July 12th, and this is Project U Radio, and this is Lynn Alexander, who seemed to be bringing in Paul Clement Roberts. And we are just, oh my gosh, we are just back from a pretty amazing trip. We were a whole bunch of us were out on the West Coast, out in California, for a whole bunch of events, practically every night out there for a week. And we're pretty tired. We're exhausted. We're going to talk a little bit about that and a little bit later on, a little bit about something called the punk aesthetic, what it is and what it means when you're looking at creative work. Is it an attitude? Is it something that, you know, in your head on the page? Is it inspired by your music? Is it inspired by your philosophy? Is it inspired by a desire to hold on to your freedom? I'm going to go ahead and see if Paul's around. And I think he is. Welcome.
Hi. Am I around? I hope I sound around. I'm very around.
You're around.
Around
so
the way.
Are you guys exhausted out there?
Yeah. I think people are starting to get their energy back. I think. You know. I don't know. I don't know that it's ever like really totally over for somebody who's involved with organizing like I am.
Right.
you find that when it goes away for everybody else, it's like, we call it the beast. And I think it just, as we got toward the end of it, that's how we referred to it. It wasn't the crawl anymore. It was the beast, because it basically chewed us, picked us up in its mouth, chewed on us, swallowed us, digested us a little bit, shat us out the other side, and then came and ate us again, and just started the whole process over and over again. And it's not quite like that now, but you know, it's still the thing. You know, it's supposed to go into hibernation, but it still has to be fed. You still have to brush its hair, brush its coat. Put some blankets over it, make sure it has a nice bowl of food and water. You know, it has to be taken care of. And so in some ways, the work never ends.
Right. Well, I would like to talk a little bit about that. I imagine you guys are in that process of sort of debriefing and processing how it went, what went right, what went wrong. A lot went right from our end. You know, and I know that you have Bitches Brew coming up. So when you say that you are always organizing, that's how it is. You sort of close one door and you immediately have to open another and get on to the next thing. So if you could talk a little bit about that series and how that's going. I was actually just talking to Frankie Metro about it.
Bitches Brew has, Bitches Brew has come around. It has moved from San Francisco to Oakland, and it's happening now on a monthly basis. And at the Awaken Cafe, 1429 Broadway, which was one of the places where the Beast Crawl had one of its readings.
Right.
And I founded Bitches Brew with Valerie Chavez from the Tenderloin Reading Series in San Francisco almost 2 years ago now. We did that, but we were kind of spotty with it, and we were kind of flipping back and forth between venues because it was tough. It's much tougher to get space in San Francisco. And, you know, and so we realized that in Oakland we were in this little window, in this little nexus, where we realize it's easy to get the space, and it's amazing because with the power of social networking, you can really organize and you can really put, like, little scenes and little events together when you have space. It's amazing how easy it becomes. But you can see that starting to change. You know, even downtown Oakland and the days and you can see it starting to get competitive. You can see
right.
The business owners
right.
wanting to put their space up, and then people are going to feel that need, and then that space is going to be filled up. And you know, because not every owner is going to go for it. You know, they have to. It's we're just very lucky that in Oakland we have a lot of business people who are very friendly to literature, and the spoken word art form.
I imagine at the end of the day, as a curator, you really have to deliver. You have to bring people in. There's that pressure, I think, when you are using a space for an event. You really have to try to work to pack the house. And it seems like Awaken is very receptive to you guys. We were there, obviously, for the after party after Zyfez, which we can talk about that venue a little bit, too, in a couple minutes when we get to that. There's just a lot of to talk about, but I'm glad that series is still going on. I'm sorry that you lost places like Kaleidoscope that are no longer, available to you.
Right, Kaleidoscope went down the wayside. Yeah, and we still play at Viracocha. Yeah. We still get little gigs in there at Viracocha. You know, Viracocha remains very supportive of the entire community. That's a really unique thing about them is that they're free of cliques and their groups and things, and they want to try to open up their space to as many different tribes as possible. But it's hard because there's a lot of tribes and there's not a lot of time in the day, and it's hard to organize these things and get them together. You know, Oakland has turned out to be a little more friendly, a little easier for organizers to sort of get things done and get their own feet off the ground, and you can see that time, coming to end pretty soon. But we do Bitches Brew as a benefit for the Beast Crawl now. We're still just donation-based. We're still not an official organization. We're still just a very loose collective, and, we survive on the kindness of others for the time being. And we use the Bitches Brew Review as one way to, generate, an operating base. But that's basically it. But, at the same time, we hope we put on a hell of a show, too. I really love that feeling of when you've got an audience that shows up and just like, wow, it's just one kick-ass reader and musician after the other. It's a great feeling.
Right. They were very supportive for our first toxic abatement, which I think went very well. I think that the venue was amazing.
Yeah.
The performers were amazing. The audience came out, and I don't know if you want to say a little bit about that. I'm excited to say things about that because, as you know, for months that's been our baby, one of our babies that we've been working pretty hard on. And, I thought it went pretty well and got a lot of very good feedback about it. So what did you think of how that went over?
Yeah, that was, I was pretty stoked with that. It was, Viracocha had just opened up after being closed for some renovation for a while. And it wasn't their first show back, but I think it was their first big spoken word show coming back. And I think, the bartender, Sean Taylor, just a fantastic writer, just a super unrecognized writer who I hope one day is, he writes, he's so out there. He's like Kenneth, he reminds me of a Kenneth Patchen type of character. And so he'll probably struggle in obscurity for the rest of his life writing in such a way, but he's just so brilliant and so great. And he just sat back and he took a point to tell me, says like, I can't believe how many people you managed to get in here. And it's like, we just have kick-ass writers who know how to read and who know how to perform. And we had, and we had that variety going on. I mean, we had very intense, sort of folk Billy rock band, Three Times Bad. Zabrina Zariski doing her very engaged, over-the-top melodrama, and a man resembling Angus Young in a diaper, and you just don't get that everywhere.
No, you don't. And one of the things that we were looking for was sort of, kind of an eclectic assembly of people, a little bit of variety, a group of people that each brought a little bit of something different to the table, and I think they definitely delivered that. I mean, we had a pretty wide range of people from really all over the country that flew in for this week of events, and it was amazing to be able to tap into that and coerce people to go along with it because.
I think that's what really makes it a festival.
Yeah.
We have a festival when you have people who are out of town mixing with the locals, and when the locals and the tourists get together and party, and weird things happen. I think that's kind of what people live for. I think that's the the tribal interaction right there.
Right. We kicked it off with Bread Workshop, which, you know, the respect that I have for Jean Lupton and what she does and her commitment
right.
to, you know, the community for years. I mean, she's been coming out for events, hosting readings, and just really.
Oh, yeah, you have to, the amount of time and work that somebody like Jeannie puts into it, you can't, it's hard to, it's hard to top.
Right, absolutely. So that sort of kicked things off, and then we had San Francisco at Viracocha Thursday, and then, of course, Friday we did the play, and then Saturday can get to East Crawl a little bit from a curator and a hosting point of view. I mean, I have to say that, you know, it was really a wonderful experience. You know, Youssef was our volunteer at that event, and, you know, he really did a great job with helping out over there. I thought the readers were great, the crowd, everything. I mean, really, as far as that event from our point of view, you know, we couldn't have really done better than what we did, I don't think, you know.
Yeah.
I know that,
oh, no, that
overall,
yeah.
as a giant, huge festival, I mean, it was over, I think last count was over 160 performers, four legs, at least 25 curators hosting different events simultaneously. I mean, it really was a beast. You know, it was an amazing undertaking. And, you know, obviously there are things that went wrong, or things that now that the first one is over, you can look back and say, oh, hey, maybe we should have done this a little bit differently. But I mean, for the most part, you guys are pretty happy with how it went, I think, right?
Yeah, and we are getting, and we're hearing about some problems too. You know, it wasn't perfect. You know, we'll get dispatches back saying, hey, you know, there were problems with sound at this place, and this thing, you know, our inventory list, it was our first year. You know, I think people out there have been saying trial and error. Well, even when you have a working model, you know, and you're trying it in a new place, in a new community, it's always trial and error. You know, when is it not trial and error? You know, is an outdoor space really going to work? You know, where exactly in the parking lot do you put the band?
Right,
you know,
right.
There were all kinds of little things that, you know, we just could have been thought out better. We're taking notes. So kicking ass, taking notes. Hopefully we do both very well. You know, hopefully we improve on both moving forward. How about that?
Right. Well, I think for the first year doing it, you know, it went pretty well. You know, you have a few things here and there that maybe, you know, you come away with a better sense of how to do things next year, a better sense of, you know, oh, well, maybe if we had done it this way, it might have been more effective, or maybe more people would have, you know, found out about it. But really, I mean, it really, the crowds were great, and, you know, a lot of people were flexible, and you know, it seemed like it went pretty well. You know, I think for next year, you guys will bring it back and be that much better for it. For having,
oh yeah,
had
no,
the
we're committed to doing.
And,
we're absolutely committed to
yeah.
doing that. It's very hard to have the event go this well and have so many things go so well and say, well, you know, well, let's not do that again. I think we've identified a cultural need in the community. There is a hunger for storytelling and poetry telling and word sharing that exists, that is real, and people, there's a very solid community out there willing to grab onto it. At least, you know, there is, and, you know, I think that exists in every community. Obviously, it's a little more impressive in a place like the Bay Area because it's a larger community here. But even that which our lit crawl predecessors and inspirational forefathers in San Francisco do versus what we do, I mean, it's hard. You couldn't always, you know, do these things. You know, it was, you know, you have to build. You have to evolve towards a place where this type of art form can be developed. I don't know, I guess kind of a deeper relevance. You know. I think slam poetry really had its time, you know, had its time and still has its place, but, you know, but clearly, you know, spoken word wasn't ready to break into a major phenomenon in the early 90s. I think this is just another way the form is evolving. You know, I think the festival form and the spoken word form is a little more democratic and a lot more accessible, and it gives more people more opportunity to share those stories in such a way. You know, it's, you know, publishing isn't everything. For a lot of people, that's all there is there's the page, and there's the book deal, and there's not much else. It's like, but if you're not really involved in the human interaction and the story sharing, the storytelling, I mean, I think that's where literature really gains its relevant edge as a social force.
Right. And you really, one of the things that I think when you mentioned accessible, one of the things that you guys really tried to do, you know, you had the different curators, Michelle and I did like too, and you really gave us the freedom to really roll with it and really select the people that we wanted to read and really find our own way with our own particular events during the festival. You know, there was a lot of autonomy for the curators with the support. You know, obviously we had the support of you guys. We had, you know, our volunteers there. We had people there to, you know, help us out with sound and different things. And obviously, you know, nod to the venue. But really, you know, it really felt like we had free rein to really do what we wanted with it, with the event, as long as we stayed within the rules, you know, ending on time and, you know,
you have to have faith. You have to have I think when you're starting out, you have to have kind of a nose for the right people. I think we hope to at some point open up and have maybe a more democratic submission based process for it.
For curators.
And those guidelines can develop over time. But it is about having faith in the various working parts of the festival. This comes together because people are volunteering. They're doing it for passion. They're doing it because they love it. And, you know, you do have a little bit more room to trust people, I think, when they're working from that passion, you know. And you take some risks, and not all of them work. But when they work, I think they work spectacularly, and it justifies the whole process. It justifies that whole kind of process, which seems a little more chaotic and a little more democratic, a little less market-friendly. You know, there's not a whole lot of profit to be gained by engaging in these kinds of activities. But what it does for us on the inside, the way it makes us grow on the inside, I think is somehow more valuable.
Right. You know, I'm very curious about that because that's actually come up in other festivals, this idea of sort of a submission-based selection process for curating. Because obviously if you're curating, you're a host, you then have the ability to in turn turn around and select readers. And, you know, I think that's a very kind of vague area for me to try to wrap my head around. You know, how on earth do you go about, you know, picking, because I really think that at the end of the day, and if this sounds harsh, it probably is a terrible way of looking at it, at the end of the day, you sort of have a balance between wanting people that you care about in your community to read and participate, but on the other hand, you have to be mindful of the fact that you are delivering a show. You need to reach an audience or eventually you'll turn around and there won't be one there. So I think you need to maybe balance the fact that you want to include people that are new, maybe that are new to the particular environment. But on the other hand, you know, I think there are sort of your tried and true performers where you know without even thinking about it that they will get there, they will deliver, and they will perform, you know, without reservation. Do you think that it's about the ability to draw a crowd or the ability to put on a good show, a little bit of both? You know, what makes for a good curator?
Am I putting you on the spot? I guess so. That's okay. Those things don't always. It's funny, you know. Yeah, making sure the people come, make sure they get there, doing what you can. You have to be kind of neurotic and obsessive about the little tiny details that you're looking for little signs that you're on people's radar, that your readers didn't forget that they had a reading that night, that because they have their own hectic, chaotic lives, which aren't, you know, which they don't have personal assistants to tell them how to, you know, keep track of everything.
So people that have, it sounds like people that have probably experience with hosting at least a few events under their belt where they've, I'm not saying that they need to prove themselves to participate. I mean, I think you guys were pretty open and inclusive, but going forward, I mean, I think you're probably looking for people that, maybe have, this isn't their first rodeo, they know.
Well, there's always a few. Well, it's a mix. You're looking for a mix. I mean, one of the great, as a curator, I guess, if you're a curator, whether you're taking submissions or whether you're just choosing out of your own subjective desires, you still have an amazing amount of power to, give a forum for people to go share their soul, if not their souls, their minds. If you're lucky, you get a little bit of both. But it has to be a mix, really, I think, the experience, the people. Yeah, there have to be a few that you can count on, people that are going to create buzz, like, oh, yeah, people are going to come out to see that person. And you want to mix those, and this is not a new aesthetic, but, you giving new voices, a shot to be heard, and lots of people, you take your chances. You take your chances. Some people find their voice immediately. The Zarina Zabriskie is like the perfect example. She basically just sort of kind of rose up out of nowhere and started hanging out at some of the Bitches Brew readings that we had over at Kaleidoscope. And I sent her a few places that she could submit. One of those being Red Fez, and some other places. And the next thing she's submitting, she's sending her stuff out for consideration, and almost immediately getting chosen. And suddenly she's blowing up and has stories, in hard copy and the internet. She's getting gigs and doing incredible shows. You saw yourself at the Toxic Abatement
right.
show. And she's somebody who's really focused on both having the page. She's a Russian. She's Russian. She has a sense of what it is to be almost a complete artist, or to have sort of being versed completely in the arts. And so she really does strive to excel on the stage and on the page. And after she's been working at it for over a year, it's amazing. It's extraordinary when somebody like that bursts out and makes that kind of progress and is that good to begin with. You don't get that all the time, but part of the pleasure of going around and going to different readings and seeing the scene is you find these people, and they are just starting out, and you recognize immediately, like, oh my God, there's something very, very special about this person and the way that they tell stories, and people are always going to gather around and listen and hang on their words because they know how to tell a story. And you can't put a price on that. People surely will try, but at the end of the day, it's almost more valuable when somebody gives that for free from their own will than charging $10 a head for a sold out set of seats of 60 or 80 people or whatever.
Right. I mean, she's a good example. I believe one of her first pieces was actually over at Old Crow, if I recall.
That would be her very first one.
Yeah. So we someday we'll be able to say that we were there in the beginning for Zarina. I'd like to get back to that idea of the complete artist a little bit, because we are intending to talk a little bit about the punk aesthetic, which I think that sort of ties into that a little bit. And I want to bring Frankie Metro on this evening also, as we talk, a little bit about the week and move a little bit into Zyfez and some of the different events that, I mean, it was just so many events. So I'm going to go ahead and see if he's around. Are you there, Frankie?
Exhale, brother. Exhale.
It sounds like we caught you at an interesting moment.
I'm candid in Albuquerque right now.
Perfect segue, in a couple of minutes to get into a little bit of talk about the punk aesthetic.
I love punk
because
mm-hmm.
yeah, you're nothing if not punk in your in your soul, man. So, when you get a when you we'll chill, it's good. But we were just talking a little bit about the week of events and how they went and how the crawl went and different considerations and processing this whole big tangle of events that we've all just, you know, participated in.
I can't begin to tell you how much difficulty I'm having readjusting to being back in Albuquerque and not being around my family, which is you guys.
Right.
You know, I'm fucking, like, really hurt that I'm not there, man. Like, it hurt me so goddamn bad to leave you guys and to leave that house, to leave the Bay Area, which is, like, I always feel this. I told Paul this while we were walking to the BART one day, man. It's, like, it's always a religious experience for me to go out there because, you know, I feel like a kinship with that whole fucking area and with, like, the people. And it seems like everybody's so open and inviting and fucking kind and really sincere. That's the biggest part I noticed about it is, like, there's so much sincerity and people there that, you know, you can really get a sense of, like, where you stand, not only with, like, the people around you, but, like, the people or the person inside yourself. You know what I mean? That's where I stand at it. It's a beautiful experience, man. And I thoroughly implore anybody that hasn't been there, please. I mean, get your ass out to the Bay Area and see some of these people. It's incredible.
Right. Absolutely. I think that it was, it really, I don't want to use the word magical, but it really was a very intense and a very important trip for a lot of us, I think, because, you know, I mean, for a lot of us, we're all sort of in one big house, and, you know, obviously there's little things that come up when you put a bunch of people in one place for that many days, but I think that being able to work through that is very important. You know, it's one of the ways that people, you know, really develop. I mean, loyalty doesn't just come. You know, you don't just wake up one day and decide, you know, that you're loyal to certain people. Loyalty is something that happens when you work through different challenges and you come out still friends time and time again. You know, that's when loyalty and that sense of family and kinship start to come into it, because, you know, you get to a point where, you know, you don't have to question anymore, are these people my friends? Do these people care? You know, you get to a certain point where you just know it inside. And I think that when that happens, it doesn't happen very often either with a lot of people. You know, it really doesn't. And, I thought it was a pretty transforming experience for us all to be out there and to share all of these different events, you know, because they were very different. You know, they were not, you know, there were a lot of different kinds of events and experiences, and it really sort of put us in different social situations. You know, some took to it more easily than others, but at the end of the day, you know, we all just had a good time together, I think. So, yeah. I'm with you on
that. There are a few things that look more natural than Frankie Metropoulos delivering a set on the stage of Viracocha. That's right.
Oh, no, come on, man. That was horrible.
I was thinking that as I was watching you, man. As I was watching you, Reed, I'm all like, this was meant to be. This was meant to be.
It was like my Mecca, dude. Like, I felt like I had fucking finally seen Muhammad. I'd seen Buddha, fucking Jesus, everybody, man. I finally felt like I fucking felt like, you know, standing on that stage in San Francisco meant the fucking world to me, man. You know,
that's a stage you have now shared with. And funny, we were talking about punk rock earlier, because back in the 80s, that space used to be a punk rock club. You can say that you've now performed on a stage that was shared by Flipper and the Dead Kennedys and the Red Hot Chili Peppers were rumored to have played a gig down there. So that particular space has its lore in, you know, kind of a counterculture that happened in a different time, a different place than where we were earlier when we were up in North Beach, up at City Lights. You know, when we were seeing, you know, we were seeing various gods and icons in that place too. You know, but it was. But I think it's funny to hear both of you talk about what it's like to be out here. I mean, it really gets me to thinking back about when I first moved out here, and everything was sort of like up in the air and uncertain about, you know, what was happening with my life as I was adjusting to life in the Bay Area. And I think what you sense is a whole lot of possibility. You feel so much potential And even when times are bad and things are looking down, there's something, there's such an optimism and a sense of hope. And I think it comes from this sense of you sense the presence of this very strong art community. You might not quite know how to get to it yet, but you get here and you think, but it's there. And I know that if I just hang around and just wait and do the thing that I do, maybe I can get to that community. And it might take a long, long time to happen. But when we do little festivals like this, it kind of blows things up for a moment. It kind of rips the cover off of everything, and lets you know, the people from, you know, kind of sort of hovering around the edges of the scene to kind of pour on in and get their little time in, and from people from out of town to come in and sort of grok and intermingle and with those people. And it's kind of, you know, my friend Javier had this way of putting it. He says you're acting just like an elementary particle collider or something. You know, you're trying to get all these particles slamming together into one really tightly packed place at a really high speed, and see what happens when they interact with each other. And that's, you're trying to see what comes out of that. What are you going to see inside of that, or what's going to come out of that? And that's why you do. I think that's why you do it. You know.
Can I just say, Paul, that the word grok is fucking awesome. I love that fucking word.
Right. Yeah, break that out. Not everybody uses that. That's a word for the older folks.
I love that word. It's awesome.
Do you know where it comes from? Yeah. You know, it was invented by the science fiction author, the guy who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land. And the puppet masters and Starship Troopers, the guy who wrote those books, I can't remember the Heinlein. I think it was Robert Heinlein. I'm pretty sure it was Robert Heinlein, the guy who made the bet with L. Ron Hubbard about, you know, being able to start a tax exempt church based around aliens.
Man. Now, you know what, we're talking about punk aesthetic here and everything. And can I just say that there is a thriving punk aesthetic in the fucking Bay Area, and I love it, man. I fucking love it. It transcends, like, fucking attire. It transcends motherfucking the old image of attitude and what have you, man. It transcends that, and I think it's more along the lines of... I don't know, it sort of, like, transmogrified itself into this, like, fucking no-holds-barred kind of wisdom that is, like, sprung in people like A. Razor, like, fucking, like, Yusuf Alawi, like, fucking Zarina Zabriskie, fucking Cassandra Dallet. Like, I saw that in those people, man. It was, like, this evolved sense of the punk attitude from the fucking late 70s, the early 80s, the fucking 90s, when we're talking about bands like the Dead Kennedys and what have you. You know, you see bands like Bad Brains today, man. You see them. They're still playing shows. And you see them today. They're completely different than they were when they were playing CBGBs in the fucking, in 79 and shit like that. You know, it's like just completely different.
Right. You saw that happen with punk bands. The punk bands that have been around, and the Bad Brains are only slightly younger than, like, the Damned. And if you just play together that long, I mean, you really become, you know, it's pretty special. It's pretty special, especially because I think their influences tend to be a little more widespread and eclectic. And although I think Flipper still goes straight for the gutter these days, and they're still playing.
Yeah. Ooh, bands like, you know, like Dead Moon. Like, bands like fucking, who am I even thinking about? Who's the band that does that song? The Dead Boys or some shit like that. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, the Dead Boys, sure.
You know, like, you see bands like that, and you see them, like, go through this whole transcendence where it's obvious that the roots are still there. You know, and fucking Aurora Kill Poet is another one that, like, exemplified that for me this week. You know, you see...
Absolutely, right? Absolutely.
When you say the roots, though, that's what I'm interested in getting at. When you talk about the roots, I mean, people think of music, people, like you said, it's more than attire, it's more than, you know, it's more than, you know, the physical embodiment of punk. I mean, when you talk about, you know, punk writers and the punk aesthetic, I mean, you know, it's definitely something inner. It's something definitely speaks to the way you live your life, the way that you approach rules, the way that you approach, you know, approach indifference about certain things that, you know, I mean, what would you say if you had to sort of use a couple of words to talk toss around with that inner core, that punk core? What would you toss out there?
Virility is one. Also, I think I have, we're talking about punk. You know, it is about attitude, but I think a lot of people don't understand what that attitude entails. It's a grit teeth kind of fucking attitude. It's that, you know what? I think one of the most, the original punks for me was a fucking actor. And I'm going to go ahead and say this. An actor was the original punk for me, and that's Lee Van Cleef. Lee Van Cleef, the quiet, cool. But you know what? If you fucked with him, he would mess you up. And that's punk to me, right there.
Defiance. Definitely there's defiance there.
Yeah. You know, like, you talk about punks, man, and like, so many people just want to associate it with, like, leather jackets and spikes and fucking, you know, long hair, fucking mohawks, all this shit, dude. Nah, man, like, you know, I don't even consider myself punk, like, you know, honestly. I just like to feel like I've got a connection with punk. I don't think anybody can really, you can't call yourself punk if you don't really have a connection with, like, what we're talking about, the core. And I think we're talking about the core. Look to Lee Van Cleef, man, every time. Every time. Look to Lee Van Cleef. That should be your fucking staple right there.
Yeah. I kind of look back. I love the image. I love the iconography of it. He's just not a little bit metal. Comes up a little metal. You don't think he's that. But that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah, he's definitely punk, man. Like I feel it. Like when I watch movies with him in it. Like we're not even talking about, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, which is like a prime fucking example. You know what I mean?
Right.
His character in that movie was straight up punk. Like that was Sid Vicious like times 10. You know what I mean? And I don't know, dude. Like, I think of punk as being, you know, obviously it's going to be anti-establishment or anti any sort of, like, staples. Any sort of, it's very Dadaist in a way, I think, punk is. Yeah. It's very visceral. It's very, it's ever-expanding. I think, you know, I mean, it's the definition of it is ever expanding. And I really see like a resurgence of that sort of attitude in today's music and in today's writing. You know, unfortunately you got a lot of blinders out there. There are still that whole Bukowski cult, that, you know, a lot of people consider borders the punk aesthetic. My opinion is two completely different animals. That's like saying Tom Waits is a punk artist. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even falling in my category.
I mean, I think that when you get into what punk writing is, as opposed to, I mean, which, you know, is you know, enters into music and art. But I think that one of the things that I sort of think about also is the ability and the courage to be vulnerable and to be imperfect and to not worry about it. To get to a point in yourself where you don't care anymore, which is very difficult to do, you know, especially with writing and people that are like emerging as writers, you know, they're very fearful of putting themselves out there, of perception, of what people think, of telling the truth, of being raw, of telling the ugly side of things. You know, there's this tendency to think, well, you know, I have to, and I have nothing against, you know, people that write about beautiful things, you know, but sort of this inability sometimes to just sort of tell it, you know, the ugly and all. I mean, I think that a little bit to me of what appeals to me, you know, one aspect is sort of that candor and that ability to say, you know what, this is what it really looks like. This is what it's really like to be in this place or to be with this person or to be doing a particular thing, you know, and to tell that story with an element of honesty. You know, even when it's ugly and even when it paints you in a very bad light, you know, I actually really admire, for some reason, I just have this tremendous amount of admiration for people that are just able to just kind of let it all hang out and say, hey, this is who the hell I am. I don't give a shit.
Brian Fugere.
You know, I don't care what you think.
Brian Fugere.
that's what he went for, you know.
Yep.
You know what, Brian is actually, you know, that's a funny that you mentioned Brian, because, you know, really, he really didn't care. I don't think he really did care. care what people thought. I think that he wanted to do what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. The first thing he said when he got on stage was, "I hate poetry and I hate poets." And yeah. I was like, you know, you're at a poetry event and you say that. That's the live and let die kind of attitude that I fucking love. And, you know, in a performance, you don't necessarily have to insult your crowd, but to let them know that, you know, you're not ahead of yourself. You know what I mean? You're not jaded by labels and what have you. And we were talking about this on the porch, Paul Corner and Roberts. We were discussing labels at one point and a particular artist and whatnot. That's what punk is to me, man. It's burning labels. It's fucking getting rid of the stamp on the back of your neck that says poet, or getting rid of the stamp on the back of your neck that says writer. And just being like, I want to transcend that, man. And I want people to not just think of like art as a separate thing from being a person. It's fucking... It's everyday work. You know what I mean?
Well, that's funny because the subject of the whole artist is what came up just a little bit earlier in this very conversation. We were talking about it is, and I think maybe there's something to that in that you draw, you know, I mean, it's quite the same context, but when you're talking about transcending, you are talking about dipping into different art forms, you know, I mean, Brian that night went completely into some sort of weird world between satire and performance art, and it was and it was uncomfortable, and it was meant to be uncomfortable. I think he meant to make it uncomfortable.
Yep.
Well, I think when he says, you know, I mean, when he stands up there and says he hates, you know, he hates poets, I think part of what he hates are the expectations, the trappings, the posturing, the pompous nature of a lot of this, you know, Brian is very different from that, and that comes through. I mean, you know, it's and you could think of a lot of people like that. I mean, I think of somebody like Misty Rainwater Lights. You know, I think that she's taken a lot of flack for different decisions that she has made, and honestly, when I look at the, you know, when I look at what she's done, you know, I think, damn, would I ever have the courage to do that? Probably not.
No.
And I'll tell you, to me, that gets this to a little bit of what I mean when I talk about the punk aesthetic, being able to say, you know what, I don't care what you think about it. I don't care if you think it's beautiful. You know what? This is not for beautiful people. This is not a realm that only the beautiful people can go to and the rest of us are locked out. I'm going to kick the door down and I don't care. That's part of when I think about that particular, you know, style. You know, I think of people like that who say, you know what, the hell with you saying I can't go to the party. The hell with you for saying that, you know, I have to sit home on a Saturday night. I'm going to go out and I'm going to find my thing, my way, and I don't care if you think what I do is ugly or over the top or, you know, I'm imperfect, I'm flawed, I make mistakes, I do stupid things, I do great things. You know, that's being a human, you know, that's being a person, you
let's
know, and I
up.
Think
I mean,
embracing that, you know.
Well, let's size it up right there. You mentioned that, let's size it up. Punk aesthetic, what is that? It's the perfect imperfection. Essentially, it's no carbon copies. You know what I mean? Like, you're an original, you're an individual, and that's what so many people are like. Don't in the punk movement don't understand is it's not about wearing your fucking like favorite band's like patch on your fucking shirt. It's about going out and making your own fucking shirt. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that's what it's
making your own band, man. Woo!
Yeah. Go start your own
fucking
band.
And not defending either choice. See, the thing is do what you want to do, wear what you want to wear, be who you are. And not defending it, not being convinced by people around you that there's something wrong with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, and in that spirit,
way.
I mean, that's very consistent, Lynn, because you in fact joined two bands while you were out here. I
joined bands everywhere. It's like it was like a running joke for a long time. People were like, you know what, you join more bands without actually doing anything. You know, I don't actually, you know, I hardly play anything. Yeah,
you became
a
tambourine player and backup vocalist in the Three Times Bad band, and who knows what you do in the Dirty Fonzie band.
Oh, shit.
right. No, I mean, I have this habit of joining bands and being, you know, sort of not clear about what exactly my expectations are, but, yeah, just wanting to kind of
that's
be
punk.
There, I think.
That's punk, right?
Yeah, that's punk, too.
Well, some would say that's groupie, but, you know, it's a fine line.
Well, that's what they said about Chrissy Hynde. You know, there was, you know, she was, you know, she was a girl who liked, you know, she liked to party with, you know, the Pistols and those Manchester boys and stuff, like, you know, she hung around that scene, but, you know, she very much, she all the time always had in her mind that she was going to get her own band together and that she was going to do it and play it together. And I don't know, did you guys ever hear the interview that Steve Jones interviewed Chrissy Hynde down on KROQ in L.A.? Mm-hmm. Oh my God, it was just so great because, you know, she was basically reminding him that they had gotten together and shagged in the bathroom once, and he'd completely forgotten. It had, like, completely fallen out of his mind. And she reminded him in the middle of an interview. It's like, well, yeah, when you and I went into the bathroom, he's like, oh, Jesus Christ, man. Oh, God. You know, and he's all like, I knew you weren't just another one of the birds, you know, because you got your band together, and I thought it was really cool that you were so together, and da 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 da. You know, like, he was trying to backtrack out of this whole thing, like, yeah, you fucking forgot.
Yeah. Well, you know,
that's rock and roll, man. That's punk, and that's rock and roll right there.
Yep.
And is the groupie mindset even so terrible? Is there anything? I mean, you know, when you think of groupie, you think used, you know, and there's that negative connotation. But you also think devotion and admiration to what people are doing,
Good point.
In an almost cult-like manner. And I think, you know, I think that there's something sort of twisted about that, yeah, but then there's something kind of cool and honoring about it too. You know, I don't know how it's
any different than a community that covers up for its child molesting football coaches. I don't see how it's any worse than that.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very different.
What about NBA fans that go back after the lockout last year and watch, you know, basketball and shit like that? I don't see any difference there either.
Well, you could piss the fans off, but, you know, they're fans. They're going to come back.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is on a certain level, isn't everyone a whore, whether you have a mortgage, whether it's to a team, whether it's to, I mean, on a certain, I think you're kidding yourself if you think that you've never compromised yourself and
we're all,
you know,
whores
the way
to the
you
electric.
Your life.
We're whores to the electric company. We're whores to fucking...
Yeah. Yeah, no,
we're whores to Walmart. We're whores to consumerism. I mean,
it's to the spectacle company.
Yeah, exactly, man. I mean, like, you can sit here and, like, brag all you want and say that you're a completely independent person and all this other BS, but in the long run, you got to pay somebody and you got to answer to somebody. If it's the light man, if it's the parole officer, if it's, like, whoever. You got
to
answer
the person that pays the bills and keeps you in your house and heat and clothing and stuff,
yep.
You know, while you supposedly live your independent. Yeah.
And that's what,
somewhere somebody's paying the bills.
Well, that's what punk is. It's not an acceptance, but it's an acknowledgement of the fact. You know what I mean? That's what's
right.
About.
But also subversion, or finding, you know, subverting, and, you know, the little ways of subverting, and that's where,
yep.
And that, I mean, I think a lot of absurdism comes out of that. I mean, I think the roots of punk are very old. I think you could argue that Dadaists were punks. You could argue that Rambo was a punk. You know,
right.
You know, maybe one, you know, one of the first ones. You know, the little street kid from the Paris Commune in 1871. You know, basically hustling off the, you know, bourgeois artist crowd. That you know, was, you know, slowly coming apart in Paris at the time, but, you know, you read that writing and it's hard and it's brutal.
Right.
And it's looking at life in realistic terms, and it's, you know, and it's about I find the punk aesthetic to be very, very old, actually, when it comes to that. And I think it comes right out of the ruins of the Romantic Age and the excesses of the Romantic Age, the excesses of industrialism, you know.
And I think Zarina got into, I was pretty excited with the show that we did with Zarina, where she talked about, you know, the kind of duress and oppression and you know, just living in a censorship society, you know, where you literally had to hide books, hide the covers, change the covers on what you were reading because it might not be allowed. You know, and yet, can you imagine having the courage to do it anyway, to be a writer, you know, and be shipped off somewhere to starve to death because, you know, you felt compelled to express yourself anyway the way that you wanted to. I mean, all of these things, when you add it all up together, I mean, to me, that's all punk. That's all the spirit of it, you know. And, you know, like I said, there's an element of defiance, and there's an element of saying, you know what, you know, I'm going to be honest about the fact that, yeah, okay, you know, we all have our masters, you know, so to speak. We all have our ugly side, but, you know, let's tell the truth about it, and let's be honest about it, and put it out there as who we are, you know, and not be afraid of it. You know, I think really that courage thing to do that is a big part of it, you know, from where what I see, you know.
Right. I mean, people, you know, people shouldn't be our biggest fears. You know, if we should run towards those people that we have, you know, irrational fears of. Run towards them, meet them head on, talk to them, engage with them. You find out sometimes there's nothing to be afraid of.
They are.
You know,
because I think we fear above all else. I think we fear consequence. I think we live our lives in fear and dread of consequence. You know, there's that quote, you know, about freedom being nothing left to lose. When you get to a point where you've been stripped down of, you know, of everything, you know, when you get to a point where let's say you're broke, you know, and you're kind of down and out, you know, on a certain level, you can look around and just say, well, hell with it then. Now I'm going to do what I really want to do, because I have nothing to lose now. I don't care. You know, I've lost my concern about these consequences that really were like imprisoned me for so many years and for such a long time. You know, always looking over my shoulder, thinking, you know, of perception or what, you know, what you have to lose in this society. You get to a point where you say, you know what, those things that you can lose in society by saying what you want to say and being who you are aren't things you really, really want, you know. We all want basic needs. I mean, don't get me wrong, but,
Well, you bring up some good points there, and I just wanted to point out another example of that from the Bay Area this week was Carrie Spencer, I think. It's like,
yeah.
I think that's probably what you're talking about. She does.
Carrie.
She is punk as fuck. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, she sure is.
Yeah, she's
she sure
cool.
is.
Definitely, man. And I enjoyed I enjoyed thrashing with her this weekend too. It was fucking awesome. Tearing up Berkeley streets on some skateboards. It was fucking badass. And you know, it's fucking A. It's good shit, man. And man, I don't know what else to say. I'm probably gonna end up dropping off here, but I just want to thank both of you guys for pulling it off this weekend or this week.
Thank you for coming out, Frankie. Really, it was perfect. It was just so perfect having you out here for everything.
Yeah,
it really was. It was definitely great to see you guys, and great to see Lindsay. Great to see everyone. Really,
it was fucking wonderful, man. And Pat, thank you. I want to thank you for driving me around Oakland on the last night.
Oh yeah, well when we had to go rescue Lynn and John.
Yeah.
I loved it. I love giving you the tour. You know, I'm proud of this town. I'm for better or worse. I'm proud of its. I'm proud of its history as the home of the Black Panthers. I'm proud of its history as the history of the home of the Hells Angels. I'm proud of its history as the home of the Oakland Raiders. You know, these are all organizations that, you know, in their own way, were all very, very punk and very, you know, and sort of tried to defy authority. We've had a lot of other movements and a lot of other scenes, and
it's a huge Occupy movement in Oakland right now.
Exactly. It's the darlings of Occupy. I think they're still trying to figure out their next move, and who knows what that is. But we know a few of those people. Maybe we'll have a few of those people in next year's crawl. So it's
right
not rumored.
Yeah. I'm going to leave you guys with this, and we're talking about the punk aesthetic. The way that Paul Corman Roberts drives his Toyota Corolla. Go ahead and say that. And you got.
I think that's the nicest thing. I think that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said about my driving.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for calling in and chatting. And, yeah, we're almost actually toward the end. We're going to sort of wrap it up a little bit, I think, here. But, Yeah, I mean, I think it's all of those things. I mean, it's a very difficult thing, I think, when, you know, to sort of capture. Like I said, I put them on the hot seat and said, you know, throw out a couple of words. It's not easy to do that, you know, when you start getting into it and talking about it. You know, it's not. But it seemed like a good topic, you know, given the week that we had out there. And you know, I want to go so far as to say that it was very liberating for a lot of people, you know, to be there and to be doing the things that we were doing and putting things together. Yeah,
and that's good, and that is punk. That's DIY. And DIY, you know, has a long, intense relationship with the punk movement. So yeah, you know, and we're from that generation. How can we not know it? How can we not feel it? It's what we build for ourselves, and we want to build these things for ourselves, and we want to have these kinds of events, these kind of open forums that let as many voices and as much variety in to you know, like everybody, you know, you got to have a little bit of anarchy once in a while. You got to have at least a little bit of controlled chaos for the beast that is our society to be able to, you know, blow some steam off and feel a little bit more human, I guess. I don't know.
Right, absolutely. And I had a very good time hanging around with Carrie. I mean, it kind of came up with that back and forth we had about, you know, when you're on the side of the road with police, you know, and that kind of argument, you know, do you cry and throw yourselves at their mercy, or do you stand there and, you know, and mutter pigs under your breath? I mean, you know, there are definitely two schools of thought on that. I, being older and in the position I'm in, you know, I'm definitely a cry and get out of it and not pay a whole lot of money and end up in jail eating bail money kind of person. But you can see the point, though, in that, and you can see that in that whole scenario is that, you know, that defiance, you know, some people just cannot bring themselves to do that. They just cannot bring themselves to accept being, you know, oppressed or pushed around or you know, that spirit is still very, very alive in somebody like Carrie, you know, and I think that's something that, you know, you have when you're young, and then unfortunately, you know, you go through a phase where, you know, gosh, you know, it's a mortgage, it's a house, it's a family, it's responsibilities, it's needing to get from A to B to C in the way that society expects you to progress, and you lose your way with that. And like I said, it really is, to me, that the thing with punk is consequences, you know, and being fearful of consequences, and, you know, and hopefully getting to a point where you can negotiate your consequences a little bit more on your own terms. You know, that's, you know, for the 40th set, you know, I think that it's about a lot of that.
I think so too. And figuring out a way to get to that beer, figuring out how to get away from that cop and get to the beer, that's also punk.
right. And I'm gonna, you know what? I'm gonna give you the last word since we're down to our last minute. So, you know, say something about the week, about the event.
We just had the largest literary festival in East Bay history out here in California. And it was incredibly democratic, and it was incredibly chaotic, and it was challenging, and we sort of had our worst natures and our best natures come out all at the same time, and I think we lived the experiment. We lived the experiment, and I think, you know, a lot of different things and a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stories yet to come out of this, and so we're going to do it again because we want to keep that going.
So. Awesome.
Thank you so much. Hey, thank you so much for that last word, and I wish everyone a fine evening.
Right, and this is Project U Radio, which is a project of the Literary Underground, which is a whole team of people: Michelle McDonald, Frank Reardon, Frankie Metropolis, Paul Carmen Roberts, myself, Lynn Alexander, and we are looking forward to Draconian Vampire Tunnel this weekend and Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet, and yeah. That's it. Thank you.